loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. We are going to talk about Turkey, its role in Syria, and the internal political and economic situation in Turkey and the plight or fate of the Erdogan government. Next, we're going to be talking about Korea. We're going to look at Mike Pence's role at the Olympics, the future of North-South Korean talks, and why the United States is pushing to go forward with new provocative military exercises designed to upset the apple cart of detente and reconciliation on the Korean Peninsula. And finally, we're going to talk about Sputnik. We're going to talk about Loud and Clear and media coverage, I would say very false media coverage, that depicts or falsely depicts how this station runs and how this show runs. That's all coming up on the first hour of Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Turkey.
Turkish government forces yesterday fired artillery shells at Syrian government forces that had moved to the area of Afrin in northern Syria to assist Kurdish fighters there. Turkish President Erdogan also warned Iran against becoming more involved in the Syrian civil war. Meanwhile, Turkey announced that it would carry out a naval exercise in waters inside the Cypriot economic zone. And 17 Turkish government employees and their families defected to Greece yesterday by rowing to a Greek island in a dinghy. We'll discuss what's happening in Turkey with Mark Sloboda, who joins us from Moscow. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, welcome back.
Hi, Brian, John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Well, thanks for doing it. We have to start off by asking something very simple. What in the world is going on in the mind of President Erdogan? It seems as though he has lost any shyness or compunction about offending his neighbors and rattling his sabers.
Yeah, this is a real shock. It wasn't so long ago that Turkey had a vaunted zero problems with its neighbors policy. And it was actually considered kind of a shining example of diplomacy in the Middle East. But starting with its support of proxies to overthrow the Syrian government starting in 2011, 2012, and increasingly complicated relations with other countries, including the United States and Russia because of that conflict, to the point where it shot down a Russian fighter on the Syrian-Turkish border, got slapped with sanctions as a result, kind of made up after that, and now estrangement from the U.S. with the Trump administration's increasing support for the Kurdish YPG in Syria as their proxies, and it's turning away from the same Islamists and jihadis such as the Free Syrian Army that Turkey continues to support. Turkey has, as a NATO member, has moved away and come very close to an actual confrontation with the U.S. as well. Add this long-standing grievances back and forth between it and Greece that have now resurfused, and animosities with Iraq, Turkey having sent military forces in into northwestern Iraq against the wishes of the government in Baghdad, playing its hand at politics there, now carving out pieces of Syrian territory, seemingly as some part of neo-Ottoman conquest. Turkey has managed to alienate nearly all of its previous allies and its neighbors. I mean, we're talking the United States, Russia, and the European Union, as well as all of its neighborhood countries, the surrounding countries. And this is not a good thing. Turkey cannot survive, or the Erdogan regime can certainly not survive if it continues to create this type of bad relations with all of its potential major partners and neighbors.
Walter Smolarek is Sputnik News' political analyst, and he's here in the studio with us. Walter, Mark Sloboda just laid this out, I think, very comprehensively. If you look at a map and you just look at the countries that surround that surround Turkey. It's as though the Turks have set out to offend just about every one of these countries. Greece, Bulgaria with the refugee issue, the Russians, the Iranians, the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Cypriots. It's a virtual ring around
the
Turkey.
Germans, as
the
well.
the Germans even, which is, and the Germans are the third largest military in NATO. What's the strategy here? And is this policy sustainable? Should it be sustainable?
Well, the strategy I think that began this chain reaction was a major miscalculation when it came to Turkey's response to the Arab Spring, because Erdogan's party, the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, has its roots in the Muslim Brotherhood. Erdogan and his government made the calculation that as a consequence of the Arab Spring demonstrations overthrowing autocratic regimes across the region, the Muslim Brotherhood would be the best organized force and therefore the most capable of stepping into the vacuum, winning elections and, you know, forming governments. And it appeared that the formation of Mohamed Morsi's government in Egypt, you know, confirmed initially that that would be the case. But the Muslim Brotherhood in almost all countries with the partial exception of Tunisia was not able to hold on to substantial power. And so Erdogan then sort of found himself trapped, right, because he alienated all of these other countries that were, you know, at least on decent terms with Turkey prior to this, you know, major strategic push to support the installation of Muslim Brotherhood related governments across the region. I think the other element to this is that in 2015, Erdogan learned a very dangerous lesson. So initially when Erdogan came to power, you know, his famous quote was, "The Kurdish problem is my problem." Like, in other words, you know, we're going to be much more sympathetic to the linguistic and cultural rights of Kurdish people, of Kurdish citizens, of Turkey. Of course, he was not at all for autonomy or separation or anything like that. But, you know, he had a much softer position, you could call it, than previous Turkish governments. However, he reinitiated the war against the PKK, the Kurdish pro-independence or pro-autonomy armed group that operates in the southeast of Turkey after the indecisive election results in 2015. So he failed to gain the number of seats that he wanted to gain. The AKP fell short. And so he reinitiated this war. And on the back of that nationalistic fervor, they called basically do-over elections, which went much better for the AKP. So this intervention in Afrin, I think, might be a reflection of partially, not entirely by any means, but partially a reflection of the internal weakness of the Erdogan government. The economy of Turkey is not doing so well. And also the MHP, the Nationalist Movement Party, which, you know, critics call it like a fascist party. It has some of its political origins in the Grey Wolves paramilitary death squads that were set up by a previous military regime in Turkey to primarily hunt down communists. The MHP had been generally supportive of Erdogan's policies. And its leader was not very popular among the base of the organization because of this arrangement. And so the MHP recently suffered a split where an anti-Erdogan faction that in some measures is more popular publicly, it's called the Good Party. That's its official English translation, the Good Party, split off. And so, you know, this some of the alliances that Erdogan had relied on, you know, have just sort of broken apart in the recent period. And so this may be another way to sort of rally nationalistic support. Certainly it's gotten the CHP, the Republican People's Party, the traditional center-left secular opposition party to mute much of its criticisms of Erdogan. So I think there's a significant amount of domestic calculations involved.
Mark Sloboda, years ago, well, not even that many years ago, actually, in the not too distant past, I'll say the Turks held out real hope of joining the European Union, and they made a lot of changes. They made changes to their own domestic laws. They made some constitutional changes. When Abdullah Öcalan, the founder of the PKK, was arrested, the Turks did away with the death penalty just because they didn't want to offend the Europeans. And the Europeans had warned them that if there was a death penalty still on the books, that Turkey wouldn't be able to join the EU. So they did everything that they believed they needed to do, and still they could not get into the EU. Do you think now that Erdogan has written off the West and is really either looking east, or has he decided just to rely on himself? And that's why we're seeing these difficult relations with his neighbors.
Yeah, I think definitely Erdogan has come to realize that he's never going to be able to bring Turkey into the EU. I think always there was a certain degree of reticence from the EU, from the, you know, the populace of the EU and even the elite, particularly with, you know, the realization of Erdogan's Islamist base. The AKP is first and foremost an Islamist party, something that they could never come to grips with as ruling Turkey. And they faced already a significant migrant, a refugee problem from other countries, much less bringing all of these Turks into the EU. That is something that, that I think many countries in the EU simply could not accept. I think it was the United States, for geopolitical reasons, that has always been pushing the EU on admitting Turkey as kind of a reward for keeping aligned with NATO and with the U.S. in the region. But the EU has always been reticent. And the one thing that we've left out of this conversation is the attempted coup out of the military against Erdogan a couple years ago now. Erdogan attributed this to the Gulenist movement, which is a rival Islamist movement whose exiled leader is in the United States in Pennsylvania, actually. And he blamed the CIA for backing what he called a Gulenist coup against his regime. Now, I myself have never seen any convincing evidence of this. I tend to fall back in that it was a badly planned and early sprung Kemalist coup, as all the other attempted coups have been. The Kemalists, the faction within the military, which have always regarded themselves as the guardians of a secular Turkish republic against Islamism. But this is how Erdogan has presented what happened with this coup to his public, and that already really started the slide in Turkish U.S. relations. And this recent moves in the United States with the Trump administration embracing full-heartedly the Kurdish YPG, rebranded as the Syrian Democratic Forces in Syria. It has, at this point, there is a wedge driven between Turkey and the rest of NATO over this issue. And it is a serious problem. Tillerson and McMaster's just made trips to Turkey within the last week to try to assuage Erdogan over what was going on. But it seems that nothing was settled. They just talk about more working groups, which is an indication that nothing was really reached in these discussions.
Right. Yep.
The United States never fulfilled its promise to have its Kurdish SDF proxies move east of the Euphrates rivers out of Manbij. And Turkey continues to be very upset about this, as well as the heavy weapons that have been delivered to the Kurds under the Trump administration. This has really exacerbated tensions to the point where Erdogan has made threats against U.S. forces in Manbij, even referring that he would give them an Ottoman slap, kind of, which is a degradation of rhetoric, which has now become characteristic of Erdogan as he embraces a kind of ultranationalist or neo-Ottoman way of governing and vision for Turkey. And that it really is putting him at odds with most of the other countries in the region, certainly with NATO, the EU, the United States, and Russia. And it, Russia has been flirting with the government in Ankara since they have at least in public made up over the shooting down of the Russian plane. And this has taken the form of the Astana Agreement, by which Russia, Iran, and Turkey have been at least making a lot of rhetoric about coming to some peaceful settlement in Syria. But it has to be mentioned that what Erdogan brings to the table is actual the jihadists, Al-Qaeda, Har al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam, which all continue to be backed by Turkey and probably to some extent through Turkey by Saudi Arabia as well. So they are literally bringing the enemy to the table with Russia. And I would characterize this not really as a partnership. I mean, Russia uses the word partnership to describe its relations with the United States as well, but as a complicated geopolitical waltz, a dance across the floor, Putin and Erdogan with daggers poised at each other's backs. And you really have kind of a Mexican standoff situation in Syria right now between the U.S. and Turkey and Russia, all with guns pointed at each other. And Turkey would like to see the U.S. and Russia go to war. And the U.S. would like to see Russia and Turkey go to war. And Russia would like to see the U.S. and Turkey go to war, at least a major rupture and a split of Turkey out of NATO. And that really brings us into the complicated geopolitical picture that's happening and has completely subsumed the civil conflict at this point in Syria.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking about Turkey with Mark Sloboda, who's joining us from Moscow. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, you said something very important a few minutes ago, and that was about this neo-Ottomanism that we're seeing coming out of Ankara. I want to talk about the military and the Kemalist nature of the military. This was really the bedrock of the creation of modern Turkey. That was a military that was independent, that was supportive of democracy, and that was secular, completely and totally secular. That is not the Turkey that President Erdogan envisions, and that's not the Turkey that Erdogan has cultivated since he was elected. And he's been in office, frankly, a long time, and it's over a decade and a half
this,
now.
And Mark, before you answer, just for our audience, this is a fundamental question.
It really
in
is.
Turkey. I mean, Turkey is 99% Muslim, and yet since the birth of the modern Turkish Republic, the political leadership under Ataturk and the military that followed have been devoutly committed. To use the word devoutly, committed to the separation of church and state.
Yeah, you know, my first trip to Turkey in the 1980s, I had gone to Turkey from the Middle East, and most of the Middle Eastern countries, the weekend is Thursday and Friday. And when I got to Turkey, I asked one of the hotel employees where I was staying, is the weekend here Thursday and Friday or Friday and Saturday? And he said, it's Saturday and Sunday. We're secular. We're not a Muslim country. And I thought, oh, okay, well, lesson learned. Well, things have changed since the 1980s. Talk about the strength, the power, the authority of the military, or the lack thereof, and whether or not the military poses any kind of threat to Erdogan post-coup.
Yeah, I think you've really seen a shift in Turkish politics embodied by the rise of the AKP and Erdogan in an Islamist direction in the last two decades. Slowly but surely, and now almost completely, Erdogan has purged the military of Kemalist elements and replaced them with Islamist elements loyal to him. I think it's kind of pointless to talk about democracy. I think it's more better characterized as a conflict in Turkey between secularism and Islamism, because there really can't be a doubt that Erdogan, you know, whatever the nature of his regime, and it's certainly not liberal, but he was and has continued to be very popularly elected with a strong majority. And, you know, this is the basic problem with the idea of democracy as a panacea. Democracy is a methodology for determining the general will. And the majority of the Turkish population has become far more Islamist, and you get an Islamist government elected again and again, and with the strength that Erdogan now has, this last gasp Kemalist coup to try to save a secular republic, although it certainly can't be called democratic, was completely defeated, and now with. The way Erdogan has conducted the purges across all the institutions of Turkish society, driving the Kurds out of their elected seats in the Turkish parliament, and arresting the vast majority of them, arresting hundreds of journalists, school teachers, purging the military, purging the entirety of the federal bureaucracy, police, social services. It is now very close to being a one-party Islamist state where the what opposition remains is almost completely neutered and ineffectual. And certainly Erdogan has used this last very weak, poorly planned coup as the pretext for what you know has been his total grab for power in the country. And I believe that it is this Islamist and this rising nationalist neo-Ottoman identity, I think, that really personally drives Erdogan. All right, when we talk about him as a rational actor, we have to consider him rational within the confines of those ideological beliefs. And I believe that is what has driven him to this disastrous foreign policy debacle in Syria, where he's managed to alienate the EU, United States, and Russia, and put his country in a very dangerous situation, even as his troops now occupy large swaths of northern Syria, doing joint patrols with jihadists. That includes, quite literally, as reported even in the Western press, and Reuters and AP, the Turkish military doing joint patrols in Idlib with al-Qaeda, you know, now with the rebranded name Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, you know, that it cooperates with. And Turkey continues to provide supplies every day into al-Qaeda-controlled Idlib province. So there are convoys of fuel trucks, ammunition, food supplies that cross the Turkish border every day. And that is the part of the duplicitous nature of this conflict and of Erdogan presenting himself as a rhetorically as a force for stability and territorial integrity in Syria.
Walter Smolarek, Turkey's a country that is generally viewed as a developed country or mostly developed country. It's got a literacy rate of something like 95%, but it has 20% unemployment among young people. Is that in part what's driving Erdogan?
So I think that there is a possibility of an explosion of mass discontent against the Erdogan government. I mean, for the moment, it does appear that he's been able to sort of configure the existing political forces in parliament in such a way that his grip is pretty much unchallenged. But, you know, I think we have to remember the experience of the 2013 Gezi Park protest, the protest that began in Taksim Square, where it was a lot like the Occupy movement that happened in the United States, where there was you know, primarily young people, but also, you know, working people of all ages participate in these massive demonstrations, hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps millions of people. And, you know, while it wasn't successful in overthrowing or displacing the Erdogan government, it did show that there's sort of this mass latent opposition to the direction that the AKP is taking the country. You know, even though there has been sort of a high rate of economic growth, the way that the AKP's economic policies are oriented, it's sort of, you know, a traditional neoliberal framework where wealth is distributed from the bottom to the top to an elite that's sort of, in a lot of ways, personally loyal to Erdogan and the AKP. There's a lot of discontent, and I think the statistic you mentioned about youth unemployment is, you know, might be one of the main drivers of this mass discontent. The HDP, the People's Democratic Party, which is primarily Kurdish, but not exclusively. I mean, it includes left wing and secular and progressive forces from, you know, different ethnicities across Turkish society. You know, they were doing quite well until their leaders were, you know, imprisoned and they became the target of very serious repression. So I think that, you know, when you consider all the different fault lines in Turkish society, the divide between the major urban areas and the rural areas is also extremely important. I think that Erdogan's plans to sort of cultivate a loyal generation that's, you know, you could use the term brainwashed with these the expansion, the vast expansion of religious schools that receive public money in Turkey. I think that that may fall flat in the face of the dire economic circumstances that working class poor people, especially young people, are facing.
Mark, we have about a minute and a half left. Do you see any improvement in Turkey's relations with its neighbors or with the United States? Is Erdogan carrying out an ad hoc foreign policy, or is there a grander strategy behind this? 90 seconds.
Yeah, I don't think Erdogan is thinking strategically or geopolitically, really. I think he is operating from a tactical level. He feels betrayed and hurt by multiple countries, including the United States, and must be said, Russia and some others. And it how real that feeling is, you know, he certainly feels that way. I actually relations with both the U.S., with Greece and others is only getting worse. And with this recent development in the past few days, we had a Russian plane shot down for a second time, this by Turkish-backed jihadis in Idlib province, and now Turkish artillery and possibly airstrikes conducted against Syrian government forces, national defense forces that are coming to the defense of Afrin, seemingly at the behest of the Syrian government. We've got a very explosive situation. Add to that the Erdogan and U.S. generals making threats back and forth over Manbij, and him threatening to extend his military invasion of Syria against U.S. and Kurdish forces just to the west of the Euphrates there. The situation is explosive, and it's only getting worse day by day.
John Kiriakou, that's an important point. The hubris and recklessness, both of Erdogan and the U.S., it's a real powder keg right now in Syria.
It is. And I agree with Mark. I think there's no strategy here.
And, you know, we thought perhaps peace would break out in Syria. But anyway.
Yeah.
I think I told you so, Brian.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. And we were joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Vice President Mike Pence was supposed to, according to Mike Pence, have a secret meeting on February 10th with Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and with Kim Young-nam, North Korea's nominal head of state. The meeting was canceled 2 hours before its start when the North Koreans withdrew. Meanwhile, the resumption of postponed U.S.-South Korean military exercises threatened the thaw between North and South Korea. We're joined from Hawaii by Christine Ahn. She is a co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute, and she is the international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. Christine, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Brian.
There was so much optimism, near euphoria, I would say, at the beginning of the Olympic Games. Certainly, it looked like Mike Pence, representing the United States, appeared to be viscerally isolated, sitting in that box, arms folded, you know, steely glazed, while everybody else, including leadership from North and South Korea, were applauding when the Korean athletes came in under one flag. What do you make about these recent developments, these comments by Pence or by the U.S. government that North Korea walked out on a talk, and also about the resumption of military exercises? That has to be something of a disappointment.
Well, I feel like we're kind of in a funhouse with a lot of smoking mirrors and just a lot of doublespeak and confusion, especially coming from the Trump administration. I think that this latest so-called news that the Washington Post broke is just an attempt, I think, to do some PR because of the just horrific performance by Mike Pence on the global stage, as not just the North and the South Korean leaders applauded. I mean, 33,000 people in that stadium all stood up and wildly cheered and cried. And this sentiment was reverberated around the world. I can't even tell you the number of people that wrote and called me to just express their deep gratitude that the two Koreas were able to come together for such an important moment and to de-escalate just dangerous tensions that were just on high all last year. And so, and it wasn't just Mike Pence that refused to stand for Korean unity. It was also Shinzo Abe. And so, you know, this kind of spin coming from the White House that it was North Korea that that canceled the talks, the secret meeting. And then they were also noting that they were just going to reiterate their hardline stance, which they publicly did in Tokyo as he was meeting with Shinzo Abe. And just for anybody that understands the tragic history of Korea's colonial occupation, the division, the war, you know, it's just unbelievable to see, you know, Japan, which colonized Korea, and the U.S., which still maintains a military occupation of South Korea, refuse to stand for Korean unity. I mean, if you go back and look at the 1905 secret agreement, the Takatsuta Agreement between the U.S. and Japan, where basically the U.S. agreed to look the other way as Japan invaded and colonized Korea, and Japan looked the other way as the U.S. Invaded and colonized Hawaii and the Philippines. So just knowing that kind of deep and troubling history is so problematic in this current moment as the two Koreas try to reconcile their differences to avert a new Korean War. As for the military exercises, you know, I have heard different things. I have heard in the news that South Korea has now been in conversation, that the conversation is ongoing, that they will consider stalling the military exercises. And then we have the U.S. jumping the gun and saying that the exercises are going to presume. We are in a critical window, and it is urgent now for the U.S. peace movement to raise our voices and to say we must support the inter-Korean peace process that is underway, and that we must urge our government to halt the military exercises, to listen to the people of Korea, both North and South Korea, that want the inter-Korean reconciliation to continue. And that clearly, by resuming these military exercises that, you know, include provocative decapitation strikes, regime change exercises, is obviously not going to improve inter-Korean dialogue.
We're joined from Hawaii by Christine Ahn. She is a co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute and the International Coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. Those are really important words, John, that Christine
indeed
mentioned, because, of course, we shouldn't just bounce off what the media is saying. The media has its own narrative, and it's trying to lead people. And of course, the corporate-owned media here, the so-called mainstream media, is not leading people anywhere in a good direction. We also have to, as she's mentioning, people themselves on the grassroots have to take action if they want peace. And everybody universally, I think, wants peace in Korea. I mean, I think it's really a narrow part of Japanese and American society, and maybe some part of the Korean military, that's sort of hooked on the old policy. On April 14th, Christine, here in Washington, D.C., people are going to be gathering in front of the White House at 12 noon and then marching for a teach-in over to George Washington University with that message, precisely that message, which is, let Korea be Korea. Leave Korea alone. Let Koreans determine their own destiny. Let the Korean people, who have been so horribly divided, become the true masters of their own destiny. And to also say, why should the South Korean government, you know, it's I think the 10th largest economy in the world, why should they be having to look over their shoulder and to see what Washington thinks when they're trying to talk to other Koreans in the Korean Peninsula to give peace a chance? That's such a critically important message. I want to ask your assessment of where you think Moon Jae-in's leadership is going. Where, I mean, not where the leadership is going, but what's the thinking right now post Olympics?
Well, I think it's hard to exactly tell. I mean, you know, I think in the Blue House, in his cabinet, he has a lot of former pro democracy activists. One of them, his chief of staff, being, you know, the person that helped orchestrate the crossing in 1989 of In Suk-young, who was the South Korean university student that crossed the DMZ. She went to Pyongyang to participate in the International Youth Festival and crossed the DMZ with Father Moon, Paul Moon. And, you know, they were arrested, as was Moon's chief of staff. And so he spent 3 years in prison. So he understands the kind of repressive nature that the unresolved Korean War, and hence the national security law in South Korea that prohibits any contact with North Koreans, you know, to be a threat to their national security. So I think you have a situation where Moon Jae-in, he himself being the chief of staff under Nobuhyun, almost having gone to the 2007 summit in North Korea, you know, having his family, his mother come from the northern part of the Korean Peninsula before it was divided, you know, deeply understand the complex situation that South Korea is in with this kind of historic, quote unquote, alliance with the U.S., which includes wartime operational control over South Korea's military. But I think you also have this like deep state, you know, that is the military, as you noted, which is also the National Intelligence Service, which is, you know, which colluded with Park Geun-hye, you know, in basically trolling on internet sites in the last election where Park Geun-hye and Moon Jae-in, you know, ran against each other for the presidential election. And she won by a narrow margin because there were all these hired KCIA people that were red baiting Moon Jae-in. So, you know, I think that there's that internal domestic battle that is taking place. And so obviously the conservatives, a lot of the older generation, you know, is part of maintaining that state of war, that Cold War paradigm that has really, I think, hobbled the advancement of South Korean democracy. But yes, I mean, it is. I mean, I recall like Jonathan Chang from the Wall Street Journal, he tweeted something like, you know, when the North Korean delegation crossed the DMZ and, you know, that woman who was the head of the Worangbong band, the women's North Korean women's band, you know, like checking out the sites, you know, he tweeted something like, oh, my God, just like here's a reality check. Get this. You know, the North Koreans are in South Korea. They crossed the DMZ. And then somebody responded back and said, I mean, get this. It's like, why is it so bizarre that North Koreans, like Koreans from the north, are in Korea in the southern part, when it's not so weird that 30,000 U.S. troops still remain on the Korean Peninsula 70 years after, you know, nearly 70 years after the Korean War. So I think this is a moment. It's a historic moment. We know that Moon Jae-in has set an agenda for trying to get a peace treaty. Obviously, that peace treaty needs to be signed between the U.S. and North Korea, as promised under the Armistice Agreement that was signed in 1953. And, you know, that is his agenda. And so we have a historic window right now for the Americans to really put pressure on our government to formally end the Korean War. And it's not just for the Korean people, Korean people's liberation, but it's also about the soul of this nation. Are we going to continue to be a nation built on U.S. military bases around the world? Or are we going to try to reinvest all of that $700 billion into our debilitating, collapsing infrastructure, you know, like how many over 50 million people without adequate health care in this country? I mean, it's just, you know, this country is in disrepair, and it's time for us to redefine what security means away from this national security militaristic framework towards one of genuine human security.
I couldn't agree with you more. John, Christine An is mentioning that trip by Im Suk-young, the young Korean woman, in 1989. I happened to be part of that delegation, and we came all the way from Mount Baekdu at the northern tip of North Korea, all the way down to the DMZ. And she wanted to cross over. She was making an international act of civil disobedience. She was sentenced to 5 years at hard labor for having gone to North Korea. But it was American troops that were blocking her way at the DMZ. And she said, Seoul is 30 miles from here. That's where I live. And you, American troops, are blocking me. It was really something. She went on a hunger strike. They finally let her cross. And she went to prison. But one thing, Christine, that really struck me about that trip was that as we went from different through towns and villages in North Korea, there was this outpouring of people in North Korea who actually just wanted to touch Im Suk-young. Because there were, and Americans don't know this, there are 10 million divided families. I mean, literally divided, starting maybe in 1945, certainly by 1950, 53, people who could never see their mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, grandparents, you know, whole generations have passed. I don't think the American people really have any kind of grasp of what that might mean, because no other nation has endured what Korea has endured. But I think, Christine, the point that you're making is also important about Americans have to take responsibility because the government that speaks in our name, even if it's not with our consent, is spending our tax dollars. The military-industrial complex started with the Korean War. It didn't exist before the Korean War. The legacy of the Korean War is terrible for Korea and for Koreans. It's also terrible for the world, and it's terrible for Americans because we're spending so much money on war and the war machine and death and destruction. We have 1 minute left, Christine, on we're speaking to audiences here in Washington, D.C. and other radio markets around the country. What's your final message?
Oh, I just think that we need to contact our members of Congress, urge them to be a sponsor of the No Unconstitutional First Strike on North Korea. That is the piece of legislation right now that is going through Congress. They need to hear from you. They need to hear from the American people that we do not want a war with North Korea that would lead to a ground invasion with, you know, over 600,000 troops. You know, who is going to fight this war? It's not going to be a clean, bloody nose strike, precision strike, as the Trump administration is misleading the American people to believe. So I think that's just the first urgent message. We must stop and prevent a new Korean War that would be waged by the U.S.
Okay. Those were the words of Christine Ahn. She joined us from Hawaii. She's a co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute and the international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Walter is also the producer, or one of the producers, of this show, Loud and Clear, on Sputnik News. You can hear our show every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 a.m. and at sputniknews.com. In this short segment, we're going to talk about the fact that Sputnik has been required by the Department of Justice to register as a foreign agent under the FARA Act. And also, we want to talk about some of the news coverage related to it, which I would have to say provides a completely false narrative. I don't want to use the word fake news because it's become a cliche.
Sure.
It's discredited, like fake news. But let's talk about what really is bad reporting, and especially from the news outlet, The Daily Beast. Walter, because you and I have worked together on this show every day for 20 months, and that's when you joined in June 2016, and this show has been on the air since January 1st or the end of December 2015, more than 2 years. You and I know pretty well how our show runs, and John Kiriakou, since you've been co-hosting, we're here every day together. We know how this station runs.
That's right.
We know how this show runs. I would say we're experts on this, right?
Indeed.
We're experts because we do it every day. So here's what the headline of the Daily Beast is. Vladimir Putin tied company given veto power over Sputnik radio guests. A new contract filled with the Department of Justice suggests that, yes, there is Kremlin propaganda on the airwaves. Now, this is Lachlan Marquet is the writer. I don't know if I'm mispronouncing his name. If so, I really apologize, Lachlan. I really apologize. Here's the first sentence. Russian broadcaster Sputnik says it's not a Kremlin propaganda outfit, but internal documents show that guests never make it onto its airwaves without the approval of a state-owned media organ close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Wow, Walter, is that
amazing.
True?
Amazing. Wow, that's shocking news to me.
I mean, you are one of the people producing this show. Means you book guests every day. Guests have never made it onto the airwaves without the approval of a state-owned media organ close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is that true?
That is completely ridiculous. That's so false. I mean, it's totally ludicrous. And we've been laughing at this because it's so outrageous. But it is serious because, I mean, this is part of like a concerted attack on alternative media in the United States. I mean, we decide who our guests are. I've never run it past somebody in Moscow. I've never called Vladimir Putin and said, hey, can we have this guest on our show? That's not how it works.
Well, okay, but has anyone from Moscow, anyone, approved or disapproved of any guest that you have suggested?
Not a single one. Not a single one.
How about you, John Kiriakou?
Never. And I'd like to add something, too, on the record. I've only been doing this show for 6.5 or 7 months. But when I was first talking to our boss, I guess he's the editor-in-chief, I think is his title, I said, listen, I want the freedom to be able to talk about anything that I want to talk about. And he said, done. And I said, but I'm talking about also the freedom to criticize Russia or Vladimir Putin if I think they ought to be criticized. And he told me that no one will ever interfere with anything that I want to say on the air. And that has been absolutely true. No one has ever asked me to say something or to not say something on the air. And it's the same with you, Walter, with the guests that we have on the show. No one has ever asked us to have a certain guest or to not have a certain guest.
No, and I think the range of topics that we cover, the range of viewpoints is much, much, much wider than any of the things that you'll see on, you know, CNN or MSNBC or listen to on NPR. I mean, the type of topics that we can cover are completely shut out. Like the war in Yemen, for instance, right? I mean, we've been covering very closely this horrific humanitarian catastrophe that's going on in Yemen. But because it's caused by Saudi Arabia and secondarily by the United States, which supplies and provides support for Saudi Arabia, it's totally shut out of the mainstream news. And so that's the right. American public is, kept in the dark about this horrible atrocity going on in the world. That's the kind of stuff that we have the freedom to cover here at Radio Sputnik and on Loud and Clear.
You know, we do 2 hours of programming a day. That's a lot of programming. And by any means necessary does 2 hours of programming. Fault Lines does 3 hours of programming. So there's 7 hours of programming. If we had to approve all of our guests from Moscow, I mean, if Moscow and Moscow has Sputnik bureaus all over the world, I mean, it obviously on its face doesn't make sense. But let's just talk about what we did today. And today is kind of like many other days. Maybe it's like every day. Listen to the stories we did. Pakistan military units sent to Saudi Arabia. Ali al-Ahmed, he's a Saudi national, an expert on the Gulf. We did the military takeover of Rio de Janeiro. We had a Brazilian expat living in Washington, D.C. The West Virginia teacher strike. We had two community activists from West Virginia. Ukraine's revolution, so-called anniversary. We had an editor of PopularResistance.org, Kevin Zeiss, very well-known website. Christine Ahn, one of the most prominent Korean Americans in the United States, came on to talk about what Mike Pence did or didn't do at the Olympic Games and what comes next for North-South Korea relations. We just did a segment on Turkey with Mark Sloboda, an American who does happen to live in Moscow. He's a former Navy guy. He is an expert on Syria and Turkey. We just had Isabel Garcia from Tucson, Arizona. She's at Ground Zero. We had talking to her about the border and what ICE is doing, what Trump's ICE agents are doing. We didn't talk to anybody from Russia about any of these guests. We never do.
Nope.
We never get clearance. No one tells us yes or no. These are people who actually, if they were on MSNBC or CNN or Fox News, the whole American public would benefit. Because these are expert voices, but they're not on the mainstream media. That's why Sputnik and that's why this show, I think, is so important as an alternative media. But then you have the Daily Beast breathlessly reporting wrongly, falsely, lyingly. Come on, let's just say it. It's a big, big lie. I want to say it again.
They made a conclusion and they just wrote around their conclusion. They never attempted to make this an even-handed article. I'm disappointed because I read the Daily Beast every day, and I've actually written for the Daily Beast. But this is embarrassing for them.
I like the graphic, Walter, that goes with the story. So Vladimir Putin-tied company given veto power over Sputnik Radio guests. And again, for the public, not true. This is not true. But the graphic is a picture of a fist, a strong fist, holding a sickle, like the sickle that goes with the hammer on the old Soviet flag, the peasant representing the farming community in Russia. And it's got the sickle cutting through human stick figures on top of a Sputnik news label. I mean, this isn't a dog whistle. This is like two or three dog whistles. The danger, red, communist. I mean, it's like 1948.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's so the sort of appealing to the old anti-communism that, you know, has become, I think, much less of a factor in the consciousness of young people in the United States, but is still very powerful because it's just reinforced everywhere in history books and all the classes that you take in school and the mainstream media. So, yeah, they're appealing to that. You know, another, you know, very common feature of war propaganda that I think we see in that piece, and I think we should be clear about what this is. I mean, ultimately, behind all of this, of course, there are domestic political calculations, but I think this raises the catastrophic danger of a conflict between Russia and the United States, catastrophic for people here, for people in Russia, for people all over the world. One of those, the features of war propaganda is the personal demonization of the leader of the targeted country, right? So Vladimir Putin, I mean, there's nothing in the article about Vladimir Putin, right? You know, Vladimir Putin has nothing to do with, you know, who comes on Loud and Clear. But there are so many allusions to that personality, and so they become the embodiment of all evil, and all things in the targeted country are masterminded by this one single individual.
You know, the thing about the story that's, because all of these stories are, you know, stories like this are disingenuous. There's wording in very arcane contractual language that's included in many sort of customer-client relationships about who has final authority, you know, if there's a dispute. So if there was a dispute, say, between RIA Global, which is producing the content here at Sputnik News, and Russia Today, the national, the Soviet, the Russian national media agency, if there was a dispute, the contract says ultimately Russia Today in Moscow has the final say. So they've taken what the Daily Beast did is they went and looked at the FARA registration, looked at the fine print of the contract language, then made a story out of it, which is actually an untrue story about how things actually get done in Sputnik. They asked for a comment from Sputnik right before they published the article. So in other words, it's kind of like a classic technique. If somebody's going to hit you, you ask right before the publication and say, do you have a comment? We made a comment. It came up a couple hours later. There was no expression on the part of the Daily Beast that there was urgency or that they were about to publish an article. And then they could run, at least in the first version, Sputnik had no comment or refused to comment, even though they really, you know, they, in other words, it was a setup.
Yep.
In fact, Sputnik has issued a statement and they sent it to the Daily Beast. And what this statement basically says is just what I said. That this is arcane contract language, which does not at all talk about or reveal or reflect what actually happens at Sputnik, but it's about how there would be in the event of a dispute between the contractor and the client, between RIA Global, the contractor here that produces Sputnik content, and the Russia Today, if there was a dispute, how that would be reconciled. That hasn't happened in 2 years.
No.
And so ultimately, when you think about the actual facts, it's an untrue story.
It is an untrue story, but it didn't fit their narrative. And so that's why they ran it and initially did not publish the Sputnik statement. They only published that Sputnik statement after we complained.
But the funny thing is, John, when I'm just looking at the Daily Beast, now they've updated the article. They finally include a quote from Beverly Hunt, who's a press agent on the for our company. And so they've included one quote from her, one paragraph. But then at the end,
yeah,
the article ends with Sputnik did not respond to requests for comments on the story.
Yeah, which is just simply
because
not
they
true.
Just haven't updated their update.
Yeah.
So they have this obvious difference in their narrative. Go ahead, Walter.
Yeah, and you know, just about these, you know, these clauses that are never, ever, ever even enforced or even known about. You know, there's tons of laws in the United States and small towns and states and cities that are just like completely ridiculous and are always ignored and nobody even knows that they exist. I'm looking at a list here. In Mississippi, it's illegal to swear in front of two or more people. In New Hampshire, it's illegal to collect seaweed at night. There are, you know, lots of towns where it's illegal for...
I've been worried about the whole seaweed collection at night thing going on. I'm glad there's a law about that.
Yeah, but you are allowed, the law says in South Dakota, to set off fireworks or other explosives to safeguard your sunflower crop. Like, that's the kind of stuff that you should think of when you read about these clauses.
Walter, can we do a segment on laws like that? I mean, if you get approval, of course, from the Kremlin,
right,
from Putin.
Right. I think they might okay that one.
If he gives a thumbs up, let's do a story about the explosives to protect your, what is it?
Sunflower crop.
Yeah. I just hope Moscow says yes. John Kiriakou, again, this is part of the Russia hysteria. It does remind me of what we thought we had left with the post-World War II witch hunt.
I had convinced myself that it was over when the Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah, but I guess it's in the political DNA of, well, it's not just the Americans. It's the military-industrial complex and the echo chamber called the U.S. mainstream media that actually is incentivized by having continued confrontation with Russia, and to make the idea, the ludicrous idea, that somehow Russia is taking over the United States. I mean, just think about it. It's just, it's not only untrue, it's ludicrous, it's bizarre, but for a purpose. This madness has a purpose to it, and that is to inflame U.S.-Russian relations, to, again, incentivize spending what we will spend, the record number of dollars on the U.S. war machine to prepare for a major war with Russia and China. John Kiriakou, Walter Smolarek, we're completely out of time. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.